This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, the state of science in Victorian England, as told through the lives of two of the greatest scientists of their times, and perhaps of all times. First, William Thomson, born in 1824 in Belfast, Ireland, died in 1907 in Netherall, Scotland. Do you know who he is? Sound familiar? No? Well, here's some more clues. In his day, he was a scientific celebrity, a master of mathematics, and one of the thinkers who helped establish ideas such as the conservation of energy, bringing that into scientific thought. He also was one of the first people to make science the mother of engineering, showing how science can be applied to creating undersea telegraph cables and hydroelectric generators. But today, the name of William Thomson, you might know him as Lord Kelvin, he was called after, named as a baron, isn't, well, it's really not at the top of people's minds. A poll in 1999 by the Institute of Physics did not name him as one of the top 10 physicists. It didn't even name him as one of the runners-up. And many people, though, know his name through the Kelvinator brand of appliances, but they don't know that the company was named after Lord Kelvin. So what happened? This hour, we're going to be talking about the life and work of Lord Kelvin and about the Victorian science in general. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my first guest. David Lindley is a writer and author of the book Degrees Kelvin, A Tale of Genius, Invention, and Tragedy, published by Joseph Henry Press. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Good to talk to you again, David.
Good to be back, Ira.
Why is it that no one knows Lord Kelvin's name? I mean, what happened to him? Well, he's got the refrigerators named after him.
Well, the refrigerator is an interesting story. He died, as you said, in 1907, and the refrigerator was named in, I think it was 1920 or 21, by a company in Detroit. So that was several years after he died. And the company was looking for a snazzy name for a new line of refrigerators, which obviously in those days were pretty new technology. And so it's interesting that they came up with this name Kelvinator, because obviously when you name a commercial product, you want it to name it after someone who's well-known. Hmm. And it tells you that Kelvin by then was a pretty well-known figure. And in fact, in newspapers, he was, you know, whenever he visited the U.S., there was talk about him in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on. So at that time, he was really regarded as almost the Stephen Hawking of his day. He was kind of science personified. And that was really what got me interested in the story when I started to find out how well-known he'd been in his own lifetime. And how much he'd rather faded from not just the consciousness of the public, but as you mentioned, even among scientists, he's known but not particularly well known these days. And so I was struck by how somebody who could be that much of a celebrity and then just fade away in a matter of really two or three decades.
It is an interesting story. Take us back. Set the scene for us for what science was like back in the days when he started making his contributions.
Well, he was born, as you said, in 1824, so he was a student at Cambridge studying mathematics in the 1840s. And one thing is that you didn't really study physics in those days exactly. He did a degree in mathematics, and he learned physics to some extent by talking to colleagues, by reading what the experimenters were doing. But the people doing experimental physics generally didn't know a whole lot of mathematics. Mm. This was really before the day when theoretical physics existed as a discipline in itself. And so, for example, people didn't know what heat was. The concept of energy hadn't been formulated. People were aware of electric and magnetic phenomena, forces, magnetism, but they didn't really know how it all connected up. And so even for a long time, it wasn't entirely clear that static electricity and current electricity are the same thing. So there was a mass of bits and pieces of experimental evidence on these subjects, and there was rather high and refined theory to do with Newtonian mechanics. But essentially, to oversimplify, that was it. There wasn't really a theory of other kinds of physics, certainly no theory of electromagnetism, no theory of heat or work or energy. So William Thomson came into science at a time when those subjects were being formed. And, mm-hmm. and he was instrumental in many ways in getting right. some of those subjects off the ground.
You had a lot of experimenters in those fields, but not knowing why they were, what was happening. You know, guys like Samuel Morse and Henry and people like that. And even before that, I guess, Benjamin Franklin. But they had no idea of the theory behind it.
That's right. They had theoretical ideas. They didn't really have formal theory right. as we would now understand it. And, I mean, Michael Faraday is another very interesting case. He was the son of a blacksmith. He was more or less self-taught. And he was very acute in his understanding of electric and magnetic phenomena. So he designed his experiments with a sort of pictorial, if you like, conception of how these forces worked. But he was not at all a mathematician. Mm-hmm. And in fact, William Thomson, when he was young, was one of the first people to try to translate Faraday's almost sort of pictorial, cartoon-like sketch of electromagnetism into a mathematical theory. And that was one of the things he was quite instrumental in his early late 20s and early 30s.
And so what started to connect him with the whole idea of the scale, of the temperature scale, like the Kelvin scale? Where did that...
The other big subject at that time, and this was to some extent because of the Industrial Revolution, steam engines were the main motive power of especially Britain's industrial economy. And nobody, in a sense, knew how steam engine worked. I mean, obviously you heat water and it expands and it pushes a piston and you get energy or work out of it. But how exactly that happened was unclear. And in the 1840s into the early 1850s, theories of heat and work and energy and how they were related were being formulated by a number of people, including William Thomson. So it wasn't really until the middle of the 19th century that people began to understand that there was such a thing as energy and that it was conserved and that when heat turned into work, the total amount of energy remained constant. And Kelvin, William Thomson in those days, was really in the thick of it, and he had a lot to do with making clear the workings of steam engine, the fact that energy was conserved, mm-hmm. and later on the mysterious second law of thermodynamics, which involves entropy and the fact that steam engines are never perfectly efficient. He also was instrumental in the early 1850s in putting a lot of those ideas together. Although there were other people, but he was certainly one of the, say, half a dozen people who really had a lot to do with formulating what we now call thermodynamics.
So did he understand this, the Kelvin scale? Did he understand about absolute zero and things like that?
That's the achievement that he got his name attached to the temperature scale for. And that was really a good theoretical insight because people had been able to measure temperatures really going back to the time of Galileo, more or less. And basically you just had some sort of gas or fluid in a chamber and it expanded as it got hot. People understood that empirically, but they didn't really understand what was going on. And more to the point, thermometers made of different substances, different gases or alcohol or water, all gave you slightly different temperature scales. They weren't identical. And so what Thomson realized, and this was in the early 1850s, you could use the theory of steam engines to establish a relationship between temperature and the efficiency of an engine, which related to the amount of work you could get from a given quantity of heat. And what that meant in practice was you could design a temperature scale which was physical and mechanical in that it was based on the amount of work obtainable at a certain temperature. And as part of that, he also realized that because of the way the efficiency of steam engine changed with temperature, there had to be an absolute zero. When you got down to a certain temperature, the steam engine was perfectly efficient, and if you tried to go below that temperature, then you would be getting more energy out of it than heat was going in, and so that was physically impossible. So that led him both to define a temperature scale on a mechanical basis and also to realize that there had to be this absolute zero.
Mm-hmm. So he was really starting from when he made these advances at age 16. He was a darling from the beginning, it sounds like.
He was really renowned. I was surprised to discover, because I knew of his name more or less as an old man when he'd become somewhat cranky and was still around. But as I look back into his early life, he was a boy genius, if you like. And in his 20s into his early 30s, he was really regarded, and not just in Britain, but in France and Germany as well, he was regarded as the greatest mathematical physicist around, and it was expected that he would be really leading the revolution, so to speak, for many years to come.
And then, and Queen Victoria then elevated him to Lord?
That was somewhat later. Yeah. He became Sir William Thomson first, and that was not so much because of science, but because he got involved with the project to put a telegraph cable across the Atlantic. This was in the middle 1850s, starting then, and finally succeeded about 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, this is why he's not so well known as a scientist. He got hooked up in this big plan to put a 2,000-mile underwater telegraph cable from Ireland to Newfoundland, and it turned out there were technical problems that hadn't been encountered in shorter cables or cables going over land rather than underwater. And so he began to work out a theory of the telegraph cable. And he was quite a lively and gregarious character, and he ended up sailing across the Atlantic five times on these cabling expeditions. He designed instruments for the cable that were more sensitive than anything that had been previously devised. So he put his science to good use. He made the telegraph cable work. He designed instruments that made it work. But at the same time, he got drawn away to some extent from pure science. And I think he just liked hanging around with these people, these businessmen, these inventors, these technical people. He got to know politicians because this was a big international project. And I think he to some extent, discovered a world bigger than just academic science, which is what he'd been involved with up until that time.
Well, the entrepreneurs he ran into, these people making money. Bell was doing all kinds of stuff at that time, right? I mean,
And he took out patents. He made money. He formed a company in Glasgow to make instruments. So, yeah, he was quite astute as a businessman as well as a scientist. And I think he just loved this new world that he found.
Yeah, he could not accept some of the basic tenets of science, even stuff that he was developing.
Later on in his life, as electromagnetic theory became established, as I said, he was one of the first people to really try to put Faraday's work into mathematical form and to begin the work of creating a theory of electromagnetism. But it was Maxwell who took that to fruition. And by the time Maxwell came along with his theory, Kelvin didn't like it so much because to his mind it was too abstract. It was too mathematical. Mm-hmm. And it was getting away from just dealing with directly measurable quantities, which is what Kelvin thought science should all be about. So around the time that he got caught up with the Atlantic telegraph cable, science was beginning to move into a somewhat more abstract realm of theorizing, and he was never quite happy with that. So I think for both those reasons, he ended up being kind of left behind from the mainstream in science.
Well, let's talk about that, because the name of your book, Degrees Kelvin, is a tale of genius, invention, and tragedy. And was that the tragic part? He was left behind in his later years?
I think by the end of his life, he himself, in some of the things he'd said, had begun to recognize, well, I'm not so sure that he accepted that he'd got left behind by science. I think he thought science had gone off down the wrong track and he was still sticking with the true faith, so to speak, and that physics had gone wrong. But he definitely felt towards the end of his life that he had become detached from some of the mainstream of scientific thinking. And as brilliant as he was, and as much as he took an interest in science till the end of his life, I think by the time he died, there must have been a sense, I'm not sure tragedy. He was not exactly a tragic character. He was sort of too busy and active to worry about stuff too much. But at the same time, I think he did understand that he was no longer part of the cutting edge, if you like. And I think there was a sense of at least detachment and unhappiness that he thought physics had gone in a direction that he didn't like.
Well, physics was moving into quantum mechanics by that time, right? Did he
by that just, time, yeah. Relativity was coming along, yeah.
These are all outside of his areas, right?
Yeah, and radioactivity had been discovered in the late 1890s, and he was not. He sort of understood that there was a phenomenon there, but he was rather reluctant to take it to its full conclusion about the transmutation of atoms. So, I mean, to some extent, he was just an old guy by then. He was into his 80s, and, old scientists
too
are not...
soon. Well, you know, the physicists, they say they do their work, and their best work in their teens and 20s. He was certainly in that category, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the interesting thing was that even into his 80s, though, he was still commenting on physics as if, so to speak, he was there with the great geniuses of all time, and by then his attitude had become anachronistic.
So physics had sort of passed him by, and he was standing still.
I think that's to a large extent true. Yeah.
And was he bitter about that?
I don't think he was, because he was a sort of blithe and sunny character, and I don't think he spent a lot of time agonizing too much about his own career. I think in all honesty, he probably thought it was sad for physics, not for him, because he thought physics was going down the wrong path, and it was a terrible shame that all this stuff was being done that was that would have to be revised later.
So did you discover why Kelvinator, you know, we don't know his name anymore? Why, you know, you can name a refrigerator after him, but now no one knows who he is?
I think he just faded. I mean, very rapidly in science, his reputation kind of drifted. So even 10 or 20 years after he died, I think his reputation as a scientist, it was also somewhat colored by the fact that he'd lived a long time and he was never shy about making public pronouncements on all kinds of subjects. And towards the end of his life, a lot of those pronouncements were just wrong. He had a whole saga about the age of the Earth, which he thought couldn't be more than 20 or 30, maybe 100 million years, which was based on correct reasoning, but just didn't, you know, left out radioactivity, which came along later. So I think he was associated with...
Got to take a break, David. You know how this works. I know. You've done a lot of radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the life and times of Lord Kelvin with my guest, David Lindley, author of the book Degrees Kelvin, A Tale of Genius, Invention, and Tragedy. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And we were talking about toward the end where Kelvin, toward the end of his life, Kelvin was sort of out of step with science. And He was, though, as you mentioned in his book, he was still renowned enough that when he died, he was buried next to Isaac Newton.
Oh, yeah, and he was a great public figure.
Yeah.
He became, I think we mentioned earlier, he became Sir William Thompson mainly because of the Atlantic Telegraph Project. That was a great success and a great stride forward for Britain's entrepreneurial culture at the time. And then later on, he was involved in other kinds of commerce and activity. He had a whole long-running involvement with the British Royal Navy. He was designing new compasses and navigational equipment. So he really did quite a lot to bolster the empire. Mm. And in 1892, he became Lord Kelvin, really as much because he was a commercial and a political success based on his scientific knowledge rather than because he was a scientist as such. So he was a huge public figure, and because he was always written about in the newspapers and because he was always very vocal, writing to the Times and his speeches were reported, he became known as the voice of science in many respects, so that by the end of his life, even though in the public eye he was Mr. Science or Lord Science, among his fellow scientists, he was already sort of drifting away a little bit. So his reputation at the end of his life was somewhat inconsistent with his achievements by then in the scientific world.
Let's go to the phones. Randy in Las Vegas. Hi, Randy.
Hi there. I just had a quick question. If in photography we use a Kelvin scale of color light temperature, for example, daylight is considered 5,500 degrees Kelvin. Is this the same Kelvin, and what, is there a relationship between the scale we use and this other scale you're talking about of actual thermal dynamic temperature?
Well, funnily enough, I have a friend who's a photographer, and when I mentioned I was writing about Kelvin, he said, oh, the Kelvin color in photography, of course. It's basically the same temperature scale, just based on the idea that there's a connection between the color. If you think of stars, I mean, our star is yellowish in color. Hotter stars tend to be blue, and that's related more or less to the surface temperature. So the Kelvin color temperature in photography is a way of categorizing color according to the temperature that you would need to create that color if it was some sort of glowing body. That leads me to remember that when I was starting work on this book, I kept coming across his name in all kinds of places. There was all kinds of theorems in mathematics and fluid mechanics. And I was talking to somebody who'd been involved in ship engineering. And he said, and I didn't know this, that I know enough about boats to know that when a ship goes through the water, the pointy end goes first and it creates waves. And there's an angle between the waves, a V-shaped angle, and that's called the Kelvin angle, because Kelvin was a great yachtsman. He had a lot to do with, he studied water waves just as a pastime almost, but came up with a lot of, little insights and theories about the behavior of waves, the behavior of fluids. So his name comes up all over in theoretical physics and in mathematical physics of that era. And I think, in a way, that's part of the problem, because he did lots and lots of stuff, but his name, apart from the temperature scale, isn't associated with any one big theory. So Maxwell, for example, when he came up with electromagnetism, to oversimplify, he went away for 10 years and thought about it and finished his theory. Kelvin sort of was going down that road a little bit, but Kelvin was just not a man to sit still and think about something for years on end. He, in a sense, had a very short attention span. He would like to solve a problem, and once he'd solved the problem, he just moved on to the next thing. Although he was a very good problem solver, and I think that was why he was so good at technology and engineering, he sort of lacked the capacity to hold a subject and just think about it for months or even years on end and bring it to a state of completion. And that was part of his intellectual strength, in that he could do so much so quickly. Mm-hmm. But I think the disadvantage was that he was not inclined to spend a lot of time pondering.
Okay, Randy?
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. So he wasn't one of these theoretical physicist types who would get in, like Einstein or somebody who had in their mind they were conceptualizing something and go away to think about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that he was. I think the reason he was so successful and so influential early on was that in those days, in the 1840s, as I said, modern science was just beginning to be formed. And really the task of a scientist or a physicist in those days was to try to connect up all kinds of odd phenomena and bits of empirical evidence and find mathematical rules. And he was extremely good at that. And that was a very valuable first step. But to go beyond that, to evolve, more complete theories and deeper understanding, he just didn't have the right kind of mind for it in some way.
Yeah, I could see, because you talk in the book about all these other little dabblings he did. For example, the compass, getting a metal compass to work on a metal ship. He figured out how to do that, right?
That was a whole other problem. He was a keen sailor. He'd grown up sort of boating on the lakes in Scotland, and when he became wealthy, he bought himself an enormous yacht and sailed around England and across the Atlantic even with it. And this was a time when boats were, you know, at the beginning of the 19th century, they were mostly wood. By the end of the 19th century, they were basically metal. And having a lot of metal on a boat interferes with the action of the compass. And a lot of people had worked on this problem. And again, it brought his strengths out, that he was able to take a whole bunch of different approaches, look at a lot of things that other people had done, and come up with a complete compass system, which he was able to persuade the British Royal Navy to adopt, which incidentally also managed to make him richer as well. Mm-hmm. But that was his kind of talent for doing so many things. And in a couple of his obituaries, there were these rather sort of sorrowful laments that it was a shame he'd got involved with technology, because think what a truly great scientist he could have been had he not got caught up in the Atlantic cable and the compass and so on. But I think that's actually not true, because he had the kind of mind that was very good at that kind of technological application. And it was probably in the end not so good at doing pure science. So I think it was probably better for all concerned, in fact, that he got involved in these technological projects.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone, see if we can get another call in here. Let's go to Jim in Kalamazoo. Hi, Jim.
Yes, I was curious about the title of your book. As I understand it, Calvin isn't reported as the Degrees Calvin, but simply as Kelvin.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
He said, is Calvin reported as Degrees Calvin or simply as Calvin, and why?
Oh, you know, it was and then it wasn't. I think when I was at school, we used to talk about Degrees Calvin, and then at some point, and I couldn't tell you when, some big international committee that decides these things said instead of calling it Degrees Calvin, it should just be called Kelvins. So now we're supposed to say, you know, 273 Kelvins, not 273 Degrees Calvin. But I just thought, for the title of the book, I think more people know Degrees Calvin, and it's a somewhat more resonant title. So it was... I think a lot of people, even among scientists, I think not everybody quite obeys the rules, so you will hear Degrees Kelvin still.
Could be the same people who wanted to convert us to the metric system. So we'll...
Well, funnily enough, Kelvin came to Washington in, I think it was 1904, and he was visiting Westinghouse and Eastman and various other folks, but he actually testified in Congress to a House Committee on Weights and Measures in favor of a metrication bill that had been introduced in the early part of the 20th century, which obviously failed since we don't have the metric system. But he was a big fan of the metric system, because he thought people wasted a lot of brain power converting, you know, foot pounds to tons and whatnot.
Right. Yeah, I do. We're talking with talking with David Lindley, author of a new book, Degrees Calvin, A Tale of Genius, Invention, and Tragedy. And we're talking about Calvin, and David, you mentioned James Maxwell, another of the giants of science alive at that time, and his ideas about electricity and magnetism helped bring about the age of electronics, helped show how light and electricity are related. Joining me now is Basil Mann, author of the book "The Man Who Changed Everything, The Life of James Maxwell," published last year by Wiley. He joins us by phone from London. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
I know. I take it that you know each other. David Lindley.
Actually, no, we don't.
No, we don't, I'm afraid.
Is that right?
Not yet, anyway.
I know the book, but not the person.
We've been talking, maybe your ears are burning, because we've been talking a little bit about Maxwell. There are people who have heard of Calvin, but I think even fewer people have heard of Maxwell. What? Tell us in a nutshell what Maxwell is famous for.
Well, if that's possible. The reason I wrote the book is that he's one of the greatest scientists of all time, and physicists generally hold him to be comparable with Galileo, Newton, Einstein, but he's hardly known among the wider public. And this is a terrible shame, not just because he deserves the glory, but also because he was a delightful man. He was full of charm, and people who don't know about him are missing an awful lot of enjoyment.
And he, I have a shirt. Somebody sent me a T-shirt once. It's got Maxwell equations on them, the four equations, I think.
Oh, yes.
And it said, and God said there was light or something, it says on the bottom.
Yes.
What are those famous equations? What do they imply, and why are they so famous?
Well, they encapsulate just about everything to do with electricity and magnetism. Not only that, they don't just tell us about electricity and magnetism, but his electromagnetic theory is one of the basic laws of the universe, and it, among other things, it links space and time, and you can't get more fundamental than that.
Mm-hmm. He seems to have, Maxwell seemed to have some the same type almost of background as Kelvin. He published papers at an early age. He was second in his tests at Cambridge, some of the same teachers and tutors. How would you rate him alongside Kelvin?
Well, certainly they were different. Mm-hmm. As I've said, I mean, physicists generally put Maxwell along with Galileo, Newton, and Einstein, where they wouldn't put Kelvin there. But I don't like comparing people like that. They were both brilliant, great men, inspiring men. They had other characteristics in common, too. They were both generous-spirited. They both had a sense of humor. They both loved natural philosophy, which we call physics now. They both got tremendous fun out of life. They had differences, too, but they had all those things in common.
David, do you know if they knew each other well?
They knew each other. I don't know that they were close friends. They certainly corresponded on a number of occasions, and particularly in connection with electromagnetism. I think Maxwell, in a letter early on, credited both Faraday and William Thomson, as he was then, with beginning the study of electromagnetism. But Maxwell then went off into his own realm. And I think it's fair to say that Maxwell was by far the greater scientist, and certainly among theoretical physicists, he's really there in the very top rank, whereas Kelvin got a little bit left behind. Mm-hmm. And I think there was sort of a certain estrangement between them later on, I think just for intellectual reasons, that basically Kelvin didn't really like the electromagnetic field. He just found it too abstract. It was this mathematical definition with, to him, no real physical reality. And I think they never quite saw eye to eye on that. And so they never really understood each other, I think, as intellects. They were very different in that respect.
Would you agree, Basil?
I certainly agree on electromagnetism towards the end, because they had a parting of the ways. Of course, Maxwell was right and Kelvin was wrong, as it turned out. But I think they remained close. And I think throughout Maxwell's life, well, towards the start of Maxwell's career, of course, Kelvin was a mentor. And then they became more or less equals. But I think that Thomson kept a sort of mentor role. All the way. Mm-hmm. They were always seeking and giving advice to each other, and they corresponded a lot, you know, among a circle of people, including Kelvin's collaborator Tate and Stokes and others. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of inspirations that Maxwell most definitely got from Thomson, you know, as he did from Faraday, particularly on electromagnetism at the start. But interestingly, there was one point that came up with the very last paper that Maxwell wrote, which happened to be on stresses in rarefied gases. And Kelvin was a referee for this paper, and Maxwell had produced some good stuff. And including in that, he'd included the possibility of a formula, but he hadn't actually produced one. He just sort of suggested things. And Thomson, who was the referee, said, "Go on, you know, you can produce a formula." And he actually did, and it turned out to be very useful. And this was very shortly before Maxwell died.
Hmm. Talking about James Maxwell and also Lord Kelvin this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Lots of people on the phones. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Brian in Louisville. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hi there.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
If Kelvin liked to diversify so much, why did he tell Tesla to focus on one topic?
David, did you know about that?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question.
So why did Kelvin tell Tesla to specialize in just one topic? Is that the question, Brian?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with Kelvin's interaction with Tesla. There was a whole dispute towards the end of the 19th century about alternating current versus direct current, and Tesla was the apostle of alternating current, and Kelvin was a rather old-fashioned guy who with Edison insisted on direct current. And I'm not sure, did they have a whole lot of personal contact? I know that Kelvin was involved with the Niagara project to build a hydroelectric power station, and Tesla also had some involvement with that, but I'm not sure what incident the caller is referring to.
Basil, do you have any idea if there was any interaction? Tesla was a giant in electronics, you know, mentally and also in the industry. Another person who gets very little credit these days. Did he have any interaction with Maxwell?
As far as I know, he didn't. He was certainly aware of Maxwell's theory, mm-hmm. but I'm pretty sure that they didn't have any direct correspondence or discussions.
Well, let me put the same question to you that I put to David before about Lord Kelvin. Why do you think that Maxwell is not a common name today? Why he's not held as highly, and is that why you've written your book?
Well, as I said, this is a great shame. It's also a bit of a mystery. The theory put forward most usually by scientific historians is that his ideas are too abstract for general publics to get hold of. I don't believe this myself. You take Einstein's theory of general relativity, for example. That's pretty abstract, and hardly anyone among the public understands it, but it somehow grabs their imagination. Now, Maxwell was a scientist with tremendous imagination, and almost everything he did seemed to have a quality of magic about it. And that this magic is well known to physicists, and I believe that it can also become well known to the general public. With things like Maxwell's demon, for example. Oh, incidentally, I don't know whether this has come up already on the program, but Maxwell's demon was a name given by Kelvin to Maxwell's little creation.
No, that hasn't come up yet. And why was it called the demon?
Well, that was Kelvin's term, which perhaps shows he had a sort of sense of theatricality, which Maxwell didn't quite have.
David, are you familiar with that phrase?
Yes. Maxwell's demon is a very... this has to do with that mysterious second law of thermodynamics, which is a little more complicated than we can explain right now. But Maxwell's demon was this little creature that was supposed to be able to look at molecules and bat them one way or another according to how hot or cold they were. So Maxwell's demon was supposed to be able to separate a volume of gas into a hot part and a cold part against the laws of thermodynamics, and it has to do with understanding the role of probability. And yes, indeed, it was Thomson who came up with this name of the demon. I think just on your earlier question about why Maxwell isn't so well known, I don't know whether Basil would agree with this, but I think compared to Newton and Einstein, there's also a question of personality and public recognition at the time. I mean, Einstein, of course, became very well known in his own time. Newton, I think, was fairly well known and was a very strange and peculiar character. Maxwell, though, I think in his own lifetime was not terribly well known even then outside the world of physics. And he was, at least I have the impression, he was something of a loner. You know, he spent a long part of his life on his estate up in Scotland. He communicated with other scientists very much, but I don't know that he was ever a public figure in his own time.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more about Kelvin and Maxwell, so stay with us. We'll take your questions. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about science, giants of science in the 19th century, specifically Lord Kelvin and James Maxwell, with my guest, David Lindley, author of the book Degrees Kelvin, A Tale of Genius, Invention, and Tragedy. Also, Basil Mann, the man who changed everything, The Life of James Clerk Maxwell, published last year by Wiley. He's on the phone with us from London, and David is in our studios in Washington. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a few phone calls in. Josh in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Josh. Are you there? Oh no. Okay, well, is Calvin from Spokane there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
I have a twofold question, which relates to the scientists being discussed, but it tends to move away from the a little bit. A while ago, you mentioned the Kelvin angle used in marine architecture, let's say, or naval architecture, and I'm aware of the Mach angle used in aeronautics, attributed to Ernst Mach, and it's basically the same angle. You have a shock wave that's generated at the bow and at the stern of an object penetrating a fluid. And in aeronautics, this begins to happen at about one-half the speed of sound, or 0.5 Mach. Are your speakers aware of any direct corollary between the work of the different people involved here? Also, I heard the mention of the name Stokes. There is the Navier-Stokes equation, which is involved in fluid mechanics, and I guess goes way back. It's very old. I don't know how old, but I would say possibly early 19th century. I don't know the history of its derivation, and I do know that, I've seen textbooks which say that its general solution is difficult, meaning that it's actually well nigh impossible unless you have a Cray computer today. So I wonder how they even undertook to do it.
All right, let me get it. David, do you, can you answer any of those?
Well, to take the second part first, Navier-Stokes has to do with fluid mechanics. This was a subject that George Gabriel Stokes was another contemporary of both Kelvin and Maxwell, and a great correspondent as well. And in fact, Kelvin and Maxwell had Kelvin and Stokes rather had a huge correspondence, a lot of which has to do with setting each other little puzzles of how water waves moved and how a certain object would move through water. The Mach angle, I'm not so sure whether Mach directly knew of what Kelvin had done. I mean, Mach certainly came a little bit later, but not too much later. And his name is associated with the Mach number, obviously, concerning things traveling faster than the speed of sound. I would think there ought to be a connection, but I actually don't know how much Mach knew about Kelvin's work. Kelvin did a huge amount of work on fluid mechanics generally, which is still highly regarded by mathematical physicists, and I didn't put much in my book for the simple reason that it's a little dry, so to speak, for the non-physicist reader. But certainly it's one of his great achievements, his many concepts in fluid mechanics.
Calvin, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tom.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if I can get Josh in Jacksonville there. Josh, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Now we got you.
Yeah, I love your show. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Real quick question, not scientific. I'm wondering where the word Kelvin came from. Is it in his name at all? I mean, why would they name him Lord Kelvin?
It's an interesting story, David. Go ahead.
This is a mysterious thing to do with the British honours system. If you get to be a lord, then you get to choose a new name for yourself. And he was born William Thomson for all the obvious reasons. He chose the name Kelvin, or rather one of his nieces did, apparently. Kelvin is a river in Glasgow. It runs beside the site of the university and into the Clyde. And the story, and one of his nieces wrote an account of her uncle, and she said that when Kelvin was notified, or when William Thomson was notified that he was being made a peer, then he was said, well, you've got to choose a name for yourself. And he said, the nieces suggested, oh, Lord Cable, Lord Compass would be good because of his achievements. And Kelvin, in his sort of somewhat childish sense of humor, said, oh, I think Lord Tom Noddy would suit me fine. And then apparently the niece and his wife came up with this Lord Kelvin as a more acceptable and serious offering. So it caused confusion. Apparently there were people writing to the scientific journals saying how come this guy Kelvin was trying to take credit for all of William Thomson's work. But just one of those little oddities of the British system.
I like the idea that he had a great sense of humor. The more I hear about him, the more I'm getting to like him. And I had read as an electronics engineering student many years ago, before longer than I want to remember. I used to study a lot about James Maxwell, and I'm interested, Basil, that the name of your book is the Man Who Changed Everything. Did you really think that much of him that you could make that claim? He changed everything.
Well, it's perhaps a little bit of hyperbole in it, but I think not a great deal. He brought in three ideas that were completely new at the time, but are now part of the foundation of the subject of physics. There's his electromagnetic theory, of course. There's the concept of the field, which is now regarded as an essential mathematical tool for representing systems of force in space. And he brought statistical methods into physics, which are now, of course, used as a matter of course. And these things, for the most part, didn't really take hold until the very late 19th century, early 20th century, by which time Maxwell had been long dead. Mm-hmm. So in this way, he was ahead of his time, which is, of course, one of the reasons why he's not better known than he is.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested about his work on the rings of Saturn, the idea that they're composed of individual moving pieces. That, you know, was that a unique idea?
Well, it came about because he entered a competition for what was called the Adams Prize, set at Cambridge University. And Kelvin was one of the judges for the prize. In fact, I think one of the setters as well. And that the task was to explain the rings of Saturn and to investigate whether they would be stable if they were solid, if they were fluid, or if they were, you know, made up any other way. And to explain the conditions of stability and give a complete mathematical account. And when he was doing his first job, professor at Aberdeen University, Maxwell decided to have a go at this. And it was an immense immense job. And when eventually he sent in his answer, it weighed something like 10 ounces. You know, it was huge. He got the prize because he worked out that they had to be composed of lots of relatively small solid bodies orbiting independently, which is, of course, exactly what they are, and which has been shown by fly past pictures.
Wow, it's interesting. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Richard, the refrigeration mechanic in Castroville, California. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I thought your audience would be interested, which the big thing about Kelvin that fascinated me was how he discovered the point of absolute zero. And I have my own perception of it, but perhaps your people would be better able to describe it.
David?
Well, I mentioned earlier that people had been accustomed to measuring temperature with a variety of thermometers, which expanded in an approximately linear fashion. In other words, for every increment of temperature, you get a certain percentage increase in volume, and that gives you a temperature scale. But they were all slightly different for different gases, different liquids, and so on. Now, in principle, if you took a gas expanding with temperature and said, well, what happens if we go down in temperature, then you would come to a point where the volume appears to be zero, and you might say that must be an absolute zero of temperature. But the problem is, with a gas, generally speaking, it will freeze or turn into a liquid or do something else before you get to that point. So people going back, I think, as early as 1600 had calculated a temperature like minus 275-ish in modern units in Celsius. But it wasn't clear that that was anything physical, because it wasn't clear you could ever get to that temperature. And really, Kelvin's achievement in 1852... was twofold. First of all, he showed how you could measure temperature in a mechanical way that was independent of whatever gas or material or substance you were using. So it was an absolute definition of temperature that depended on measuring work and energy and so on, rather than trying to measure the expansion of one gas or another. And then from that, he was able to prove that that temperature must have a zero, not because of anything to do with the expansion of a gas, but because of considerations about the efficiency of a steam engine and so on. It was really quite a remarkable piece of work, and I think even now among physicists it's not quite appreciated how much of an insight there was in that little paper in 1852. So I think at least he is deservedly recognized in the temperature scale for that achievement.
Talking about James Maxwell and Lord Kelvin this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You know, I have to throw this out because this has been on my mind all day, knowing that we'd be talking about Maxwell. Did Maxwell have a little silver hammer? You know the Beatles lyric, Maxwell's silver hammer? I'm just wondering if they just threw that in because Maxwell might have had a silver hammer that he... I guess not, from the silence on the other end. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get another phone call or two before we have to go. Let's go to Harry in Walnut. Is it Walnut Creek, California, Harry?
Yeah, California.
All right, go ahead.
I've got two quick comments. First of all, Maxwell, it's a worthwhile visit to visit his birthplace, where they have a museum, and it is a fascinating place. It's on India Street, born in 1831, and it's just behind Princess Street. But the real comment I want to make is to give credit to Lord Kelvin. I have on my wall here a quote he made before the Royal Society in 1883, and it says as follows: I often say that when you can measure what you are talking about and express it in numbers, you know something about it. But when you cannot express it in numbers, your knowledge is of a meager and unsatisfactory kind. I have used that so often in engineering meetings, and it silences people who wish to pontificate on a problem rather than define it. That's my comment.
Well, that's the essence of science, putting those numbers on it.
Yes, Kelvin was an absolute fanatic on the measurement and the production of numbers in discussing a problem, and that's very valuable today.
All right, thanks for that.
And also, one thing just to mention in connection with that, another of his less well-known achievements is that he was instrumental in establishing the modern system of electrical units. And Maxwell also had a hand in this because he and Kelvin, working together, figured out ways of measuring resistance and voltage and so on in an accurate way. And in the early days of telegraphy, people tried to measure resistances, and basically they had a piece of wire that they carried around with them, and this was their standard of resistance. And, you know, person A had his bit of wire and person B had his bit of wire, and that was how they compared resistances. So between them, Maxwell and Kelvin and a number of other people set the electrical measurement system of volts and amps and ohms and so on the modern basis. And that, too, was really a profound achievement because it made a lot of technology possible because you were able to compare and standardize things.
1-800-989-8255. John in San Antone. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I just want to make a comment about what was said earlier about why Maxwell may not be very well known. I'm an engineer as well, and one of the reasons is that if you're not working directly in pure science or electromagnetics, you hardly ever use Maxwell's as a quantity. Everyone uses ohms, volts, Henry's, farads, etc., even Gauss and Newton's if you're in, particularly Newton's if you're in metric measurements. But very rarely do you ever use Maxwell's unless you're dealing directly with that science. So it's not something that's repeated often. Maybe that's one of the reasons as well.
What is a Maxwell? John?
Pardon?
What is a Maxwell, a measurement of?
Boy, you're taking me back to theory now. I couldn't tell you.
Maybe Basil knows. Is there a Maxwell unit?
It's one that's, I think, not generally used now because it's not within the commonly used system of units. It's a measure of electrical, of magnetic flux.
Ah.
But it's a bit ironic, really, because, as David has said, Maxwell and Kelvin together, it was actually Maxwell and a couple of other people who did the work, did an experiment designed by Kelvin to establish the first units of electrical resistance. And at the same time, Maxwell and his colleagues doing that proposed a whole system of electrical units, which was later adopted, you know, almost entirely, as they proposed. So it is a bit ironic that you have nowadays commonly used units named after all sorts of other people, but the Maxwell is one that hardly ever comes into things.
There was a car, right? But that was a different Maxwell. Yeah, I remember, you know, what's really interesting to me, and we really don't have time to talk about it much, is this era of all these people being alive at the same time. You know, all these names that we brought out, the units are named after just about, you know? And the interaction, and what it must have been like to be a scientist around there to bump into one another, you know?
Yeah, it was a very fertile period because the latter half of the 19th century, to my mind, was when modern physics really became established.
Yeah.
And not only that, it also was the time, and here was, I think, where Kelvin was so instrumental, where the idea of science leading to technology or of commercial or industrial objects being scientifically designed came about
David,
in a big way. So
for another time, we've got to go.
Okay.
David Lindley, author of Degrees Kelvin, A Tale of Genius, Invention, and Tragedy, and Basil Mann, author of The Man Who Changed Everything, The Life of James Clerk Maxwell. Thank you both for joining us this hour.
Thanks a lot, Ira.
You're welcome. We have to say goodbye, so we'll see you next week. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.